Hi everybody, my name is Jimmy Dean. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jimmy.
Wow. I've been sober since August the 25th of 1997. And I'm extremely thankful for that this evening. And I am, it is certainly my honor and my privilege to do anything at all for Alcoholics Anonymous, but it is my distinct privilege and honor to come up and be a participant in your 20th anniversary. What a fantastic milestone for you. I am a member of the Chicago group of Alcoholics Anonymous, smack dab in the middle of Dallas, Texas. You get a few drunks around a table, sober drunks, but drunks nonetheless, and you're in Dallas, Texas, and you think about a name for a group, and somebody spins a format out there, and that format that they spin out there is from a group in Chicago, Illinois. And we like that format. It's a 90-minute meeting format, AA participation the first 20 minutes, 10-minute break, and then a main speaker. We run that around the room, and then we try to decide what in the world are we going to call this newly formed group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The person that brought us the format said, well, it comes from the California group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Chicago, Illinois. So we said, therefore, it just makes perfect sense to us that we would be the Chicago group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Dallas, Texas. So there you go. And our Wednesday night meeting, of course, a much smaller venue. We're talking maybe 70, 80, 90 people, but people with enthusiasm for sobriety, people in enthusiasm for Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's a palpable feeling. It's a feeling that's in this room. We get it on Wednesday night, and I think you would be hard-pressed to come away from a meeting like this and not have what I consider to be an accurate representation of what AA is really all about. So I take that back home with me when I go home on Sunday, and my cup will be filled from the recovery group in Billings, Montana, and so I owe you my gratitude for that. And Will, I sponsor Will, and I asked Will to do something, and I said, would you like to go to Billings, Montana with me? And he said, that sounds like a great idea, and I said, we're going at the end of November, and there was silence on the other end of the line, but we're both here, none the worse for wear. So here we go. I'm here to tell you in a general way what I was like and what happened to me and what I'm like today. If you can't tell from the way that I talk, I was born and raised in Dallas, Texas. I was born and raised in a little area of Dallas called Lakewood. Lakewood is a little bitty town in the middle of the big city. Everybody knows everybody else's business in Lakewood, and they like it like that. We do not need a newspaper. We don't need anything other than the grocery store checkout line. You can find out what everybody did last night. You can find out what everybody's about to do tonight. And you can really find out about what tonight, tomorrow. And they like it like that. My mother was from South Louisiana, a place called Metairie, right next door to New Orleans. She had come to Dallas to go to SMU. My father was on part-time faculty at Southern Methodist University, a geology degree, geophysical degree. Two or three people that I've talked to that knew him back then said that he was a brilliant man, but he was also a fun guy to be around. My mother obviously found him fun. She was in a couple of his classes, boy met girl on SMU campus. And a couple of years after that, she graduated from school. A year or two after that, he asked her to marry him. And a year or two after that, they had me. I was their only child. When I was a little bitty boy, my dad traveled all the time. My mother stayed home. We had some hippies that lived in our garage apartment, and they had me. And so she was busy raising those hippies and raising me. My dad would travel. You know, I was a little bitty kid, but I remember he would leave late Sunday night or early Monday morning. He'd come back late Thursday night or early Friday morning. Every time he'd leave, we'd play this thing called the going away game. And when he'd come back home, we'd play the coming home game. When we played the coming home game, he'd say, Jimbo, reach in a pocket. And I'd reach in his breast coat pocket, and I'd find an Arrowhead, or I'd find a Hot Wheels car or a Pez dispenser. And he'd sit down, and we'd sit on the couch in the den, and he'd tell me about these fantastic places he'd been, like Alamogordo, New Mexico, or Brawley, California. He'd been out on doing some kind of a job. And, you know, we had a good home. I don't remember any yelling in my house. I used to say when I first made talks in Alcoholics Anonymous there wasn't any drinking in my house, and that's not true. My parents were young, they were gregarious, they were party kind of people, and it was just not the kind of drinking that I was going to learn to know and love. You know, people came to the house, and in the 60s you knew they were coming because they put ashtrays out. Everybody smoked. They were these enormous ashtrays. I remember I'd look down from the landing upstairs and I'd see these ashtrays, and probably against the law to own one today. I mean, they were so big. And they put these ashtrays out, and guys in black would bring ice, and you knew something was going to happen. They'd make little four tops, and they'd play cards, and they'd play some music, and then, you know, it was the strangest end of the evening. I mean, I couldn't reconcile it with anything I was going to do later on. I mean, the people that came together left together. The police didn't come. Nobody set anything on fire. You know, so my perception that there was no drinking was adequate, I mean, or accurate for me. I can tell you, it was really cold at Colford, Dallas, Texas. It was late in the year. I can just tell you that I hadn't started school. And my dad was leaving again, and there wasn't anything strange about that, because I knew from the time that I could ever remember that, you know, he left, and we played that going-away game, and there was just a few rounds of the clock, and then he always came back home. I remember I was standing there on that back porch of our house, and we were watching him go, and when I say we, I looked up, and my mother was next to me, and that seemed awfully strange that my mother would be standing there. And I remember that she was crying, and I thought, why in the world would she be crying? Because she knows just like I know that in a few days he's going to come back. And I was probably 5 years old, and I wasn't going to see or hear anything again from my real father until I was 19. And I was a sophomore at SMU, and I got a telephone call one day, and there was a young woman on the other end of the line, and she said, "Are you the Jimmy Dean that I'm looking for?" Well, my drinking career had started by the time I was 19, and I never said yes. I was the Jimmy Dean that you were looking for. Until we found out why you were looking for me. Anyway, we talked for a few minutes, and she was the daughter of a woman that my father had married, and she had lived within 6 or 7 miles of me all those years, and she called me to tell me my father had a stroke and died. To my knowledge, he never tried to affect any contact with me after he left that house all those years ago. I'm sure my mother sat down with me and did whatever you do to sit down with your child and say, our marriage just didn't work, or Daddy and I just don't stay together, or we didn't stay together. I don't remember any of that. I remember within a year or a year and a half, I had started school, and all of a sudden on a Friday night, my mother was getting powdered up and painted up. I mean, it was going to be good, obviously. And so I stood outside to find out what was happening. She was going off on a date. We heard this guy long before we ever saw him, this guy that was coming to take her on a date. Wasn't a lot of roaring going on in Lakewood 40 years ago. Not much roaring going on over there today. He had glass packs and a bright yellow convertible. I don't mean taupe, and I don't mean off-white. I am talking lead paint full of whatever, glow-in-the-dark yellow. I mean, the street was black, coal black, couldn't see anything at all. But I can tell you, I spotted that car from the porch. You could see that car, and he had his name, Jack, painted in red on the side of the door. He got out of the car. He had lamb chop sideburns and curly black hair, and he saw me on the porch, and he picked me up, spun me around, And I can tell you that I felt something. I think I loved him from the first time that I ever saw him. And obviously my mother was pretty fond of him too, or she wouldn't have been getting all prettied up for that date that night. They were going off to this little place called White Rock Lake. And I can tell you, I got some experience with White Rock Lake later on down the line. And you do not need a tow-headed 6-year-old kid in the backseat of your convertible when you're going off on a date to White Rock Lake. So they dumped me off. They left me at his mother's house, and she's the only family that I have today. He's going to become my stepfather. She was my stepfather's mother. And I remember that he dropped me off. They dropped me off. They were going off on that date. And I was not a kid who was very gregarious when I was growing up. I wasn't a friendly child, I don't think. I'm sure I was an odd child. And I wasn't afraid until she opened her front door. When she opened her front door, I mean, I remember being filled with fear, and this is almost 40 years ago. She opened her front door, and there was 5 feet of regular, sweet woman and 5 feet of flaming red hair. You've never seen hair. Nobody grew hair like, I mean, it piles and piles and piles and piles and piles of this hair. And I remember I ran for the car, and they pulled me back. And I thought, how in the world is she doing that? What in the world is keeping all of that up there? Because if that hair comes down, we're all going down. And she bent down. She welcomed me into her house. I saw she had complete control over the situation, which she would many, many other situations on down the line. And anyway, what I've just described to you is the beginnings of a family. My mother fell in love. He fell in love with her. She was a devout Catholic, went to church every day that I can ever remember when she was alive, and so she had to go through the processes that she needed to go through in order for them to marry, and so they got married, and before my third grade year, we moved from Dallas, Texas to Lafayette, Louisiana. My mother was so excited she could barely stand it. She's walked around on tiptoes for days on end. She was going back to her people. South Louisiana is really not part of the United States. They kind of pretend like they are, but they're really not. She wasn't getting to Metairie, but she was getting close. And we bought this big house on the New Iberia Road. My stepdad was a stockbroker. He got a business opportunity down there. And for the next year, I just ran with Thibodeau and Arsenault kids, just like they'd been Smith kids and Jones kids in Lakewood. And they talked mush mouth, and I started talking mush mouth. They took French in the third grade. I took French in the third grade. I just tried to run around like a little Cajun kid. And we had a good year. At the end of that year, my grandmother flew down to Lafayette to pick me up. She's going to take me back to Dallas for the summer so my parents could go off and take some trips. They were going to do some things they had not had the opportunity to do. And so she flew down to Lafayette. My mother took me to the airport that next morning. And back in 1973, you could get on the plane. There wasn't any security about anything. And I remember when my mother got up on the plane with me. She sat next to me and she said, "We're going to go and see these wonderful places. We're going to do these wonderful things. And I'm going to call you as often as I can. I'm going to send you postcards and I'm going to write you letters. And you won't believe how quickly that the summer will go. And then we'll all be back together here in Lafayette." She kissed me on the cheek and she left me and we flew to Dallas. Next morning, I was upstairs in my grandmother's house and I heard all this ruckus downstairs. I heard the phone ringing off the wall. I heard people laughing and talking and all of this stuff going on. And so I went downstairs, and when I hit the last tread on the stairs in the kitchen, there were about 40 or 50 people in that kitchen. And I thought, what in the world are all these people doing here? Why are they here? And it just got as quiet as it could possibly get. My grandmother looked at me and she said, "We've got to go back to Lafayette. Your mother's had an accident." I was 8 years old and these people obviously had not been around my mom as long as I had. And I remember thinking, what in the world is the big deal? Because I knew exactly what accidents were, especially as they related to my mom. I can tell you that cars were huge back in that day and she drove the biggest of the big car. And if she was within 300 feet of you out there in that parking lot, she backed up and hit you. And she kept her little slip of paper, and she'd write on that slip of paper, and she'd say, "Jimbo, run that note." And I would run that note and put it underneath your windshield wiper, and she would put her head in her hands, and she'd say, "I've had another accident. I've had another accident." And that's what the little eight-year-old boy thought all that stuff was about. My grandmother, a couple of her sisters and brothers, my stepdad, we got on the next plane we could to Lafayette, Louisiana. For the next 8 days, from before the sun would come up in the morning until long after the sun would go down at night, I remember I did two things. They would drop me off in the waiting room, the Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital in Lafayette, Louisiana, and they had these little square ceiling tiles that had millions of little dots in them, and I'd sit there and I'd count the dots in that ceiling. And I'd look down that hallway at my mother's hospital room, and I'd think, if I could just get in there, if I could just hold her hand, if I could just whisper in her ear, I can fix it. I know I can fix it. And a priest came by 8 or 9 days after we started that deal. He gave me a prayer card, and he said, "Think good thoughts about your mother," and that's the way that they let me know that she had passed away. She'd been run off the road by something or somebody right after she had dropped me off at the Lafayette airport that morning. And I can tell you, I was 8 years old and up and through coming to Alcoholics Anonymous at 32. I would have sworn to you, if she hadn't taken me to the airport that morning, that never would have happened. So we packed up that house as quick as we could. We got back to Dallas. We had a ranch at a little place called Glen Rose, which is south of Fort Worth. My dad, my stepfather, he went to that ranch. He called me on the weekends. I was back in the same elementary school, and he'd say, "How you doing? Have you hooked up with your old friends?" I talked to him for a few minutes, and I hang up the phone, and I think he should be here with us because he's my dad, and this is his mother, and we're a family. And I didn't understand. I'd hear my grandmother talk to her sisters, and she'd say, "He just needs time. He misses her so much, and he's hurting so bad." And 11 months after my mother died, everybody was there. The kitchen was the same. It was just as full or fuller than it had been before. The only thing that was different is my grandmother was crying so hard she couldn't talk. My stepfather committed suicide in the living room of that ranch house, her only child. And I remember thinking through coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, why didn't you go down there and get him? Why didn't you go down there and help him? Why didn't you go down there and stop it? Why didn't you go down there and fix it? None of that stuff has anything to do with me being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I earned my seat, as all of us did. I drank too hard for too long. Alcohol did something for me, does something for me, that it does not do for the average temperate drinker. And I can tell you behind your podium tonight that I feel sorry for the average temperate drinker. Man. Because I need a drink. And what happens for me is... My grandmother raises me. I have people that are blood related to me, and you know, they summer in one place and they winter somewhere else, and they can't be burdened with raising a 9-year-old child, and she says, "I'll take this child and I'll raise him." And I'm happy to report to you that today, she's 91 years old. She's the only family that I've got. And she depends on me today because of you. She depends on me today because of what you have taught me to do. She depends on me today because of principles that I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, accountability, commitment. I showed up at her house every Sunday the first 2 years I was sober before she quit making other plans on Sunday. That's the kind of guy that I was. That's the kind of guy that came to you. So she raised me and she gave me tools for living and she told me right from wrong and she said we don't steal and we don't lie and we don't cheat. I got those values a long, long time ago. I had a toolkit. And I got to be a freshman in high school and I've had sips of beer and sips of wine. My gosh, I mean, I'm raised Catholic. I mean, we drink for everything. But I've never had what I would consider to be a conscious drink, and I'm a freshman in high school, and go figure. The other thing that's happened to me is I like school. In fact, I love school. I love school, and school likes me. I like teachers. I like study hall. I like carrying more books than anybody else. And you get to high school, and you're a nerd. I never knew I was a nerd. I had to get to high school, and they had to tell me I was a nerd. So I'm a freshman at Woodrow Wilson High School, and I've got two friends. Freshman nerd only needs a friend or two, and they're identical twins. So we're a triumvirate of nerds roaming the halls of Woodrow Wilson High School. We find out about a senior beer bust. We don't know about beer or bust. I can guarantee you we're probably going to write some kind of report about the beer bust. We went to White Rock Lake, and we watched them bust, the beer bust, And man, it was on. I mean, they tapped that first keg and they got happy, and they tapped that second keg and it was unbelievable. They set a tree on fire and the police came and it was magic. And at the end of the evening, I had my first conscious drink. I had two cups of hot foam from a tapped out keg at the hill at White Rock Lake, and that drink didn't change my perception, but I saw everything they were doing. I equated with what they were drinking. And so within a couple of weeks, I found those kids that were in my high school, as they are in every high school, the kids that would help me find my element. And they needed resources that I could provide. And they said, you need a hardship ID, you need a driver's license, and you need a vehicle. And I got those things within a matter of 24 or 48 hours. I had a brand new Firebird hardship driver's license. I'm 15 years old and I'm ready to go. Well, Greenville Avenue is where you find out where everything's happening. So this junior girl needs to get to Papagayo Disco. I don't know any more about the disco than I do about the beer bus, but it's 1978, and that's the place where you need to be. And we got in there, and I knew fear like I had never known fear before. People are ancient old, 25, 30 years old in that place. It's amazing they were still able to stand up. Ramming into each other on purpose, just banging into one another on purpose, I've never seen any of that before. And somebody said Amaretto Sour, and I said, I'll have Amaretto Sour. And I had 1, 2, 3, 5, 9, however many it took, because the very first drink did exactly what I expected that it would do. It began to take the fear away. And so if it would work that way in smaller quantities, then larger quantities would just have more of the desired effect. And that's what happened for me. And that squeaking, squawking Bee Gees music, I found out the next day, you know, the drunk ended like thousands of drunks would end. I got sick. I blacked out. I passed out. They got me out of the men's room. The next morning, the phone was ringing. I was not thinking about taking vodka in my lunch pail or coming to AA or anything like that. And they said, man, weren't you wild last night? Didn't we have a good time? I said, when are we going to do it again? When are we going to do it again? I had no idea that drinking that night really affected me differently than it did any of that other big group of kids that I had known, my same age, my peer group, that year, that night. But it did. And so I drank whenever I could. We had a bootlegger by the time we were senior in high school. We'd make our orders on Wednesday, and she'd come by on Friday afternoon and deliver whatever it was that we needed for the weekends. And you know that school deal, you know, that had to settle. The guy who was going to be the valedictorian was no longer eligible to be the valedictorian. You know, studying just didn't seem to be that big of a deal anymore. Because, man, we're having fun, you see? And I didn't know that there was any problem with breaking your curfew so you could continue to drive around until you finished the last of whatever you had that you were drinking that particular night. I had to come to AA and read our text to learn about the phenomenon of craving. I didn't understand about any of that, but I had that at 17, 18 years of age. I applied to a lot of prestigious universities. I was accepted to a lot of prestigious universities. I went down the road to SMU. I was one of a group of incoming freshmen they called president scholars at Southern Methodist University. I was on a full academic scholarship. My first sponsor would say I tested well and I had potential, you know, which is the kiss of death. Anyway, what happened for me is I went down there and, you know, there were 20, 25 of us, I think, incoming freshmen, and go figure, 24 of the 25 made that dinner with the president of Southern Methodist University, one man out. That happened to be me. You know, you drink a fifth of gin the night before and you can't make it to dinner with president of the university. And that yo-yo deal is exactly how my college career went. I was once again settling so I could drink the way that I wanted to drink. Had no idea that that's what was happening to me at the time. It's only much, much later on down the line that I look way, way back and I realized that I made decisions based on how I wanted to drink. I did other things. There were, you know, we would sit around. These are the party kids. SMU is known as a party school. 20 or 30 of us would meet at a bar on Greenville Avenue to have three or four pitchers of beer. And then go figure, they would follow through with whatever the plan was after the beer. They had post-beer plans. They had movie, they had dinner, they had library, they had finished the research paper, they had whatever they had. And they, you know, they disseminated. They went out and did whatever they wanted to do. And I went to Waco or Austin or gone for 3 or 4 days. And so it just continued. I finished SMU. I graduated in 5 years on a four-year degree program with a degree in international business and French. That's all about ego. I lived and worked in Dallas all my life. And I'd gotten this job for beer money in June of 1984. I went out to apply for this job, and they said, you can kind of come and go as you please. And I said, man, that is the checkbox I had been looking for. I need that come and go as you please. And you know, last June, I'm 23 years with the same company. How in the world do you do that? I've sponsored guys who've had 23 jobs in 1 year. And I held on to that. I never drink at work. Now, I was sick 35 or 40 days that last year before I came to you, but I never drink at work. I'm there about 10. Have to get out of there about 2. Anyway, I work for a small family-owned company, and I pitted husband against wife and wife against husband, and I created a lot of controversy. If you do it in a small company like I did, you do it in the kitchen. You whisper in people's ear. You try to stir up as much stuff around you as you possibly can around you so they don't focus on you. When I made direct amends to those people after I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, individually, one-to-one, per my sponsor's direction, every single one of them said, we would have fired you years ago if your grandmother hadn't called over here and begged us not to. She said, if you fire him, he'll go home and he will certainly die drunk. So I learned about humility, certainly, through listening to those people talk. I finished school. I couldn't get to commencement. I got my first DWI. You know, I figured if you'd like to have a good time, you're probably going to get in a little bit of trouble. Got in that drunk tank, I called, snot slinging everywhere to my grandmother, and I said, get me out, get me out. If you get me out, I'll never ever let it happen to me again. I said prayers that night. I remember those prayers, get me out, God. If you let me out of this, I will never ever do anything like this again. I will live a different way of life. Within 4 or 5 hours, he was a good lawyer. He had me bonded out, and so I believed in God. I believed in God. He existed, of course. Because he delivered in the time that I had allocated for that to happen for me. So I'm running through my life. People are getting married and they say, please come to our wedding because we've known you all our life. But under no circumstances do you come to our reception. You can't come to the reception because when you came to the barbecue on Sunday and you were still so drunk, we couldn't get you in the car on Wednesday. That's a problem. When you pee in the middle of the living room floor, that's a problem. When you say stuff that scares children, that's a problem. And you don't remember, larger and larger pockets of time, we're having to fill you in, or we're having to take care of you, or we're having to follow you around because we're afraid you'll wander off. I mean, you know, that kind of stuff. I'm 25 years old, and I'm like a patient with dementia. It's the same description. I mean, I'm somebody who you cannot trust, absolutely. You have no idea. I am more or less insanely drunk, and I'm a long way from Alcoholics Anonymous. The end for me is I went to a Christmas party. I wasn't invited to it, but that had never stopped me before. It was for the biggest client that my company had. You see, I needed to do some public relations for me, and I figured I'll get over there and I'll talk up a good game, and boy, they're really going to be glad that they've got me on their team. So started drinking about 11 in the morning so I could really be well-oiled in order to speak to my position. Get over there about 7 at night. I can't speak to anybody's position. So anyway, I fall flat on my back, and that's just a cycle, just like a round of liquor stores. I'm making a round of emergency rooms. You know, you go on a 4 or 5 day binge. You fall around, break an arm, break a leg, whatever. I hit those emergency rooms all over the city of Dallas, and they ask those pesky questions. 0.29 on a Sunday morning at 10 o'clock. It appears that you might have some problem with drinking. Just put some stitches in my head. You know, just give me a pill. My heart will stop beating 160 beats a minute eventually. Let's just move on. I've had the opportunity in Alcoholics Anonymous for the past 4 or 5 years to talk to a group of first-year medical students at Southwestern. Southwestern's best and the brightest, some of the best and the brightest medical students. And you go over there on a Tuesday, and from 9 to noon, you tell your story and answer their questions as it relates to the disease of alcoholism. And then you basically sponsor that group of first-year medical students, and they come to an open AA meeting with you, and then they ask more questions. And I can tell you that they might be the best and the brightest when it comes to medical students, but they can ask some really stupid questions about drinking. Cardiac arrhythmia, didn't that concern you? And I said, yes, it did at the time. But after you gave me Lanoxin and Digitalis and a prescription for 30 days of something, it was fixed. It was done. I didn't worry about the ramifications of any of that stuff. And it didn't happen all the time. You know, it wasn't that big of a deal. So all these scars are professionally repaired. I got them all over me. This one, I'm the proudest of that I could ever possibly be, because this one I repaired myself. Towards the end of my drinking, I'm thinking, I do not want pesky questions. I do not need more prescription medication. I don't need any of that other kind of stuff. The depths of the disease of alcoholism are such that when I collide with an iron coffee table in the living room of my apartment and I lay there for 3 or 4 hours and almost bleed to death, we guess, but obviously that I didn't. And when I finally get up off the floor and I go in there and I look in that medicine cabinet mirror and I've got this eyebrow laying down here over the eye and this part of my head way up here, even a drunk like me can say, you know what? This looks pretty bad. But I remember that my grandmother's the baby of 9 children, and those 5 boys always said that duct tape fixes everything. And so I hold those 2 pieces of my head together and slap a big piece of duct tape on there. And I go for the only solution that I know. Absolutely the only solution that I know. Remember the stuff that takes the fear away, that takes the pain away, the stuff that makes tomorrow seem like it's 1 million years away? I go for that solution because that's what I know. And I have one drink and then probably another and maybe even another. And 45 minutes, maybe an hour later, I go back to that same medicine cabinet mirror and I go back with the exact same gash, except an hour later, you can only begin to imagine how black and blue that must have really been. And I pull that tape away from that scar and I can tell you that alcohol tells me that that really doesn't look all that bad. Insanity. Cannot differentiate the true from the false. So here I'm coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. God Almighty. I got a second DWI. I got a second DWI because I was continuing to have fun. And I rear-ended a woman at Skillman and Abrams. It's a huge intersection in Dallas, and thank God I didn't hurt her. And they scooped me up like Gumby from the middle of the intersection and threw me in the drunk tank. I'm 30 years old. Once again, I'm bawling and squalling, snot slinging everywhere. Calling that grandmother. Calling that grandmother who I probably hadn't talked to in 4 years. Saying, get me out. If you just get me out, if you just fix it, I'll never let it happen to me ever, ever again. Praying to God. Praying to God maybe for the first time in 9 years since the last DWI. If you get me out, if you get me out, I promise I will not live this way anymore. I will try my best to live a new way of life. My grandmother says, no, I'm not doing that. Absolutely, I'm not doing that. So now in the story should be, there's the element of surrender. It's time. Not for me. I call her lawyer. I tell him that she'll be glad to pay any bill that he'll provide. I get him to come down there and bond me out. And by this point in time, I'm angry. What's happened to me over the course of years and years of drinking is the mood swings are violent. We have absolutely no idea. Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, exactly as the book describes. And so at 5 o'clock in the morning, I'm a 30-year-old man going to an 80-year-old woman's house and beating on her door until she comes downstairs. I've ridden over there in a yellow cab because I don't have 2 nickels to rub together in my pocket. And when she opens her front door, I don't say, I surrender. I don't say, I think this drinking is getting the best of me. I have no idea what's happening. I need some help. I say, you get out there and you pay the cab and you fix it because you owe me. And that's what's coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I got that DWI and I got that probation. And in May of 96, the conditions of probation included many things, along with two meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous a week. And I thought, my life is over. And so I took that court sheet and I crumpled it up real good. I went to one of the biggest groups in the city of Dallas and I got a book. I went to the group after, of course, their 6 o'clock meeting. 7:05 I showed up and I was lucky. That's a group where after they drop their hands, I mean, they're out of there. You know, they pray and they're gone. This guy in the office and I said, I need a book. Now, he sold me the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He certainly could have sold me anything. He could have sold me the service manual. It could have been anything. But he gave me the big book, and I used anything in italics as the topics for meetings. And I used different colored pens, and we got 130 groups in Dallas. I visited all of them, go figure, and never darkened the doors of AA. Because I wasn't sure about very many things anymore, but I was sure that Alcoholics Anonymous, there is no way in the world Alcoholics Anonymous had a solution for my problem. Now see, contempt prior to investigation, I have no idea about anything about AA, but yet I know everything there is to know about AA. And I've decided that you guys cannot solve my problem. Because I know the meetings last 8, 10, 12, 14 hours. I know they last forever. Because you have to stay, if you're not sleeping or working, you have to stay in the meeting. And you all gather together in the meeting, and the way we open the meeting is, I say, oh, are you sober today? And you go, oh yeah, I'm sober today. And then we just go around the room, around the room, around the room. So for a year, I stayed away from Alcoholics Anonymous. For a year, the drinking became as desperate as it could possibly be, worse than it had ever been before. In May of 1997, I was court-ordered to state jail or forced into this outpatient treatment program. So from 4 o'clock to 9 o'clock, Monday through Friday, I bargained for outpatient treatment so I could continue to drink. And treatment, that treatment part doesn't matter. What matters is that very first day in that treatment program with a bunch of kids, they were 16 or under 16, and I was 32, we went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to my very first meeting of AA. I went to a 6 o'clock discussion meeting in one of the biggest groups in the city of Dallas. Probably 150 people in that group. I went in there with the 8 or 10 adolescents from the treatment facility and me. I don't remember anything at all about the meeting. At the end of the meeting, they offered a desire chip. Would anyone like to try our way of life for one 24-hour period? I can guarantee I did not want your way of life. No, no, no. The kids in the treatment program said, get the chip, get the chip, you got to get the chip, get the chip. I said, I don't want that chip. They said, you have to get the chip because it's part of the meeting. You have to get the chip because you're brand new. So I got up and I took the chip. And when I sat back down after we closed the meeting, out of all those 100-odd people that were gathered together, there were a couple of weirdos in that group. Watch out, because there's probably a lot of weirdos in this group. They're the weirdos who wait around for a few minutes to greet the new man who's made a commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous. There were two of those men that night. One of those guys' name was Drew. Drew and I were polar opposites, absolutely. Drew had tattoos from the top of his neck to the tips of his fingernails. I was practically born in coat and tie. He had ear screws in every available spot. And he came up and he shook my hand and he said, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Drew and here's my telephone number, and if you want a drink tonight, you call me. And if you'll be at this exact same meeting tomorrow, I'll be here. The longer I have the opportunity to stay with you, the more vitally important that is, that greeting, that meeting. The more I understand that for me, that particular night, Drew gave me every single thing that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous needed to give me in that very first meeting. He gave me the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous and he gave me hope. And he gave me a commitment. And he fulfilled the commitment that he gave to the new man. That was not my first day of continuous sobriety, but in short order, some arrangements were made for me. And I went to a meeting at the group called the Big Book Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Dallas, Texas, in the middle of June. I sat across a picnic table from a guy that looked just like Larry Bird. And he said, my name is Greg, and I'm going to be your sponsor. And I didn't even really know anything about sponsor, what it was, where it was, what it was about. He said, I want you to tell me a little bit about yourself. And so I talked for a little bit about me. Even though I was brand new, you couldn't shut me up. And so I'm sure he probably did whatever he needed to do to say, okay, you've said enough. Now it's time for me to talk about something that makes some sense. And he said, I have a sponsor and I'm willing to be a sponsor. I read AA literature every day. I attend committed meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I belong to a home group. I take commitments in that home group. I hit my knees in the morning and I ask God for a day of sobriety. If I enjoy that day of sobriety, I hit my knees at night and I thank God for that day of sobriety. I hit my knees because I humble myself before the God that I found in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I never say no to a request from Alcoholics Anonymous unless I have a prior commitment. And he went on and he explained the dynamics that were behind each and every one of those things that he lined out for me. He gave me a direction. He said, you will call me every morning at 7 o'clock in the morning. You will read at least 2 pages of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, every day, beginning at the very first page in the book. You will call 2 other male members of this group on a daily basis. You will take a commitment in this group, so on and so on. Not anything that would be a surprise probably to most of you. And so from the middle of June until August the 25th of 1997, I put a little Jimmy Dean spin on what Greg had asked me to do. I called when I was up. I went to meetings when I could get over there. I kind of had a commitment, but, you know, it seemed to me that if I didn't show up, it got done anyway. And they'd ask me to go places with them, you know, like dinner or dessert or coffee or something like that. And, you know, I always had other plans. Other plans, which meant I went home and I sat on the couch and felt sorry for myself. And so on the night of the 24th of August, I went home with 1/2 gallon of Skol vodka and I drank like there was no tomorrow. I drank as much and as long as I possibly could, and something happened that never happened to me before. My body got knee-walking drunk where I couldn't even walk, but my mind wouldn't go. My mind had been infiltrated by your faces. My mind had been infiltrated by your eyes and the sparkle of enthusiasm, the vigor with which you approached the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and most importantly, how you told me about your lives both before AA, when you came to AA, and today. And I could not explain how you got here from there on your own. It was no longer coincidence. God is doing for me what I cannot do for myself, one day at a time. So the disease of alcoholism drove me to my knees, and one of the guys who I hold in very high esteem in Alcoholics Anonymous says, when opportunity meets desperation, and that's what happened, I think, for me, because the opportunity was there. I fell in with an enthusiastic and an active group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and, you know, those people made plans for me. I had meetings to go to on a nightly basis. My sponsor said, don't ever fail to go and hear the stories of the members of your own home group. Listen to where they came from and listen to what happened to them and listen to what they're like today and learn and grow from that experience and hit your knees in the morning and ask God to keep you sober. Even though you don't think that the prayers are going any higher than the ceiling, repetition strengthens and confirms. And he just kept on telling me that over and over again. And I said, my mother was one of the most godly people that I ever knew. And she's not here and she hadn't been here for years. And he said, you're a human being. How in the world can you begin to comprehend what's in God's design? Don't try to analyze all these things that have happened to you. Don't try to blame anybody else. Alcoholism is a condition of your own making. And fortunately for you, there's a venue in which you can turn all of that to great effect. And that venue is the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Your worst possible past can be your greatest asset in the rooms of AA. And so there were a few guys that we were the class of 97. I mean, they had been sober a couple of months when I finally threw in the towel and I got sober. And I picked up and I did everything that my sponsor asked me to do, including driving 40 or 50 miles each way to bring them to meetings 4 times a week. And we had this, I know it was a sick deal, but we had the meeting before the meeting, the 3 newcomer guys in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I can tell you that a lot of times it was whack and it was off the wall. But also a lot of times it was about sponsorship and it was about accountability and it was about me and a member of a home group. And it was about, in short order, with 2 months, 3 months, 4 months of continuous sobriety, that we were talking about the new man and how we would be able to pass on to the new man what was given to us. How in the world do we get him to see to the meeting on Friday night or the meeting on Saturday night? Not beg him to go, but just tell him like we were told, which was basically a form of let's get in the car. Let's get in the car. Let's get in the car, and if we go over here, we're going to hear this great talk. We're going to hear a miraculous story of recovery. We're going to hear something that we would not be able to hear anywhere else. And they just made it sound so attractive, and it was attractive. And so I went through the steps with Greg, and at 2 years of sobriety, he retired from Alcoholics Anonymous. I had 2 years sobriety. He was 7 years sober in AA, and he left Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had shadowed him. And until he left, I didn't realize that I put way too much emphasis on the messenger rather than the message. And you know, in my experience, we mourn for people, I think, for a while when they leave AA. He made a request to me. And I can tell you today that's one of the most important things that's happened to me. When he left the fellowship and he called me to tell me he was leaving AA, he said, will you still contact me? Can I have lunch with you periodically? And I said, anything that you want. You've really given me everything, anything that you want. And those meetings over the course of the next 2 years were vitally important for me because I saw something. I saw something really, really important for a guy like me, a very vital example. To my knowledge, Greg did not drink, but he changed. He was not the same person. He was not the same man that he was when I knew him in the rooms of AA. Over a period of time, it seemed like that accountability, that commitment, the responsibility, the service to others, the connection that he had, the spiritual connection seemed to slip away. And Baxter, in 3 days' time after Greg left, Baxter B. became my sponsor. He was my grand sponsor when it came to AA. And I went to Baxter and I said, I don't understand. I don't understand what's happening. And Baxter said, you don't get to keep what you have here when you leave here, whether you drink or whether you don't drink. It just seems to be something that no sufficient substitute unless we find something. And so I've tried to the best of my ability to honor those people who gave so much to me for fun and for free. Tonight, with 10 years of sobriety, which is just a flash in the pan, but I can tell you I'm still attempting to repay the debt of Drew, who shook my hand in my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have not yet repaid that debt, nor will I probably ever be able to. I got hooked on corrections. I got hooked on going to prison. Go figure. I tried my best to stay away from prison, all that drinking. At a year of sobriety, I got three things. I got a one-year medallion from my sponsor. I got an application to volunteer in the Texas Department of Corrections. And I got my name put up so I can take the phones at night for the Dallas Central Office. And so the men that I sponsor, when they have a year of sobriety, they get those same three things. I pass on exactly what was given to me. And I was full of fear when I went to that maximum security penitentiary at 13, 14 months of sobriety, and I was welcomed into a group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The only difference was those guys were all in white. And I spent the whole morning with those men, and I can tell you that a lot of those guys, 10 years later, they're still in the same place. They'll be there forever. But over the course of years, the way that things have transitioned and changed, I've had the opportunity to sponsor men who have come to me before they've been incarcerated, intoxication, manslaughter, things of that nature, And I've used those sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous as a resource for me because they're in there. They're living that 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I'm drawing from their experience. They have assisted me in carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to men in certain areas in which I have absolutely no experience. When I get a letter from a guy that says so-and-so, how do I respond to that? Now, what happens for me? What's it like today? Alcoholics Anonymous has certainly, it's changed my life. It's changed my life because I have the opportunity to be of service today. I learned a long time ago in Alcoholics Anonymous that we had greeters just like you do here at this group. From the time that I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, the two groups I've been a member of, we always had greeters. I hated the greeters when I first came into AA. Despised the greeters, especially the hugger greeters. No, not the hugger greeters. And so I went to my sponsor, of course, and I said, you know what, that's a little weird, those people out there greeting like that. So the following Saturday night, I was a greeter. You complain about the cookies, you bring cookies. I learned. It took me a couple of years, but I finally began to learn, I said something about that, and go figure now I'm doing it. Anyway, so I became a greeter, and what happened to me over the course of a very short period of time is my life began to transform. I began to look forward to seeing those people, especially the people that were, let's say, on the fringe, either on the fringe of throwing in or on the fringe of walking out. And when I shook your hand and I hugged your neck or whatever I happened to do, I really cared when I said, "How are you doing?" I really began to care. And up and through today, that is one of the most, that's one of the most tremendous gifts that I've received from the program of AA. That grandmother, I made direct amends to her. She's the only family member that I had. And I told you, 2 years, I went to her house every Sunday because my sponsor told me when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, every Sunday you will go to her house. You will not tell her that why you're doing it, that you're doing it for some form of a commitment. You'll just show up and do anything and everything that she asks you to do. And so I did that until May of this year. In May of this year, she went to a rehab facility. She started falling in her house. She was 90 years old and she couldn't live at home anymore. And I can tell you, for years before that happened, Sundays were her days, and I always got over there. And before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, on many, many occasions, over through the most of the course of my drinking, I would have telephone calls with her that went exactly like this. Perhaps some of you in the audience can relate, because I believe that drunks have at least one person that loves them unconditionally, and she's that person for me. And when I came to AA, I would have told you that my drinking was all my own business. Stay out of my business. She'd call early on a Saturday morning and she'd say, "I've had the flu for the past week and a half, and I really need a prescription picked up, and I just don't feel like going. I just don't think I can do it." I answered that call because she caught me early enough in the morning. And I said, "Let me get in the shower and throw some clothes on and I'll be over there. Give me an hour and I'll be over there." And then I sat down and I made a fatal mistake. I made a grave mistake. I didn't realize at the time the mistake that I was making is the first drink, right, that kicks in, and that's what's going to happen. And I just need to smooth out a little bit. I just need to calm down. I need to calm down. Then I'm going to get in the shower. I'm going to go get that prescription. I'm going to go over there. It's the least I can do for that woman. Obviously, I'm an orphan, and she raised me, right? And so I sit down and I have that first drink, and I have another drink, and I have another drink, and a couple hours later she calls again. And when she calls again, I don't answer the phone, but I stand up and I stare at the answering machine. I stare at the answering machine and I listen to her talk, and she says, "I'm sure you got busy. I'm sure you got a whole lot of things on your plate, but I really do need that prescription and I don't think I can get over there and get it. Call me and let me know when you're coming." So I sit back down on the couch again. I don't know how many hours pass by. The phone rings again. And when I hear it ring, I'm angry. I'm angry because that's somebody trying to get into my business. And the other end of the line, she speaks to this very softly and she says, "I won't be mad at you at all if you'll please just call me and let me know if you're okay. All I want to know is whether or not you're okay." The man that came to Alcoholics Anonymous couldn't even do that. Couldn't even do that. When she went to the rehab at the beginning of May at 3 o'clock in the morning, she fell in her bedroom. She didn't hurt herself, thank goodness, but she couldn't get up on her own. She crawled to the telephone, she picked up the phone, and she dialed my number. I answered the phone because that's what AA taught me to do. And I said, "I will get my clothes on and I will be over at your house within 30 minutes. And within 30 minutes, I showed up over there. That is definitely all a result of what you have so richly and freely shared with me since I have come to you. What's the price for that? A little bit of inconvenience? Oh, much, much more. I am forever indebted to the program who has given me life, given me sanity, given me the opportunity to try to the best of my ability to get out of myself and try to do something for somebody else. And because you've offered that opportunity to me over the course of the weekend, I tell you again, congratulations, and so much I thank you that you allow me the opportunity to come up here and help celebrate your 20th anniversary. And I hope I get the opportunity to greet and talk to each and every one of you. Thanks very much.